Hi everyone, Robbie here. I'm excited to announce my debut horror novel, Conquest, is out and available now, both in ebook and physical format. Here's a short description. Tensions are running high in the small mountain town of Conquest, Idaho. Newly elected Sheriff Heather Hill is on one side, toxic and corrupt Mayor J.H. Beter on the other, a standoff in a culture war. With the wildfire approaching, battle lines begin to form. As the Cold War heats up, Heather and J.H. are at each other's throats, but they have more to worry about than the fire. The Pack has arrived in Conquest. A ravenous gang of bestial shapeshifters, they are hungry and eager to show their dominance. Conquest makes a perfect target. Now Heather, J.H., and the people of Conquest must fight for survival as blood and ash fill the streets. It's a great book for fans of Stephen King or bloody werewolf stories, and I encourage any fans of horror to check it out. The link to purchase it is in the show notes or can be found on my website, robbiedorman.com. I've worked very hard on it, and I'd love for you to check it out. And this is the Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome! Today, I am joined by Andrew Bloom of the AndrewBlog.net to discuss the 1983 comedy, Trading Places. It is one of my favorite comedies, and this time, I am on the defense as I try and repel Andrew's criticism. That is largely fair. We talk about how comedies age, about the train wreck of a third act, and how the film treats people of color and women. It was a great talk. On to the discussion. I'm here, once again, with Andrew Bloom of AndrewBlog.net to talk about Trading Places. Andrew, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Robbie, and I'm very excited that you and I get to do some Trading Places. I feel like normally when we disagree, you are the doubter and I am the defender, so it's good to mix things up true to our source material here.
The subtitle for this is The Assassination of Trading Places by the Coward Andrew Bloom. Just let you know. I thought of that one when I was mowing my lawn. So it's I don't know why. I've never even seen that movie, so I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah, we're talking about Trading Places, the 1983 comedy starring Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Murphy, and others. But those are the obvious. They're the people on the poster.
And the rest.
I mean, it frankly, it is a very good supporting cast for a relatively small ensemble picture. It has both Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy, but then has Ralph Bellamy, Don Ameche as the Dukes, and then Denham Elliott as the butler, as Coleman, and Jamie Lee Curtis as Ophelia.
In addition to future Senator Al Franken. Future and former Senator Al Franken.
Yeah, future former Senator.
And Frank Oz, for that matter.
And they're apparently one of the... Richard Hunt was the dude who played one of the Duke's helpers, and he was a Muppet performer.
Yeah.
I did not know that. What Wikipedia will teach you. Okay, so...
He's Bert, I think.
I know it was a lot of them. I briefly looked at all the different Muppets he played before he passed. Now, you might ask out there in Radio Land, why are you guys talking about Trading Places, a comedy from 1983?
Why not?
I mean, that is always the, you know, because I want to, is always an answer. But I think there was one of those Twitter surveys going around, name your top five comedies. I think this was in, is that what that was that I put this on my list? I think I did.
I think that's right.
Yeah, and then you were...
Rained on your parade.
You rained on my parade, Andrew. You made me feel... Well, you didn't make me feel bad. I still love Trading Places, despite its problems. You pointed out some flaws in the film, which some I agree with and some I don't. But we're going to talk about how Trading Places is a great movie, and you're wrong, and how I'm right.
And just like in the movie, I am going to prove Robbie's theory wrong through an elaborate and unnecessarily convoluted scheme.
And we bet for $1, and whoever loses has to pay. I love Trading Places. It is, I think, a formative comedy for me. When I was young, I saw this many times, along with Coming to America. These are, they are like a pseudo, like Coming to America has... You've seen Coming to America?
I have seen it in pieces. It's one of those movies I saw when I was a kid on cable that was always running, but I don't think I ever actually sat down and watched it from beginning to end.
Okay, well then that's our next podcast is Coming to America.
have our whole Eddie Murphy 80s comedy series.
I think you'd like Coming to America more than this. Although I'm not positive about that, but I think you would. But it has the Dukes come back in a small cameo in Coming to America, because it is also directed by John Landis with Eddie Murphy.
I always appreciate the sort of not really continuity, but kind of wink-wink continuity between comedy projects.
Yeah, they come back, they are beggars on the street, and Eddie Murphy plays an African royalty, and he throws them money, and they say, "We're back," because he throws them like thousands of dollars, because he's infinitely rich as a king. Or Prince, I should say, in that film. But Trading Places, back to Trading Places, is formative for me. I watched it much younger than I probably should have when I was probably 10 or something the first time I saw it, I imagine.
Probably it's a little early for a movie with as many curse words and boobs as this one has.
My parents were not protective of me, and I was a precocious, smart child, so they were like, "Hey, you can handle it. He can watch this, so he'll be fine."
There's nothing scarring there.
No.
Clearly didn't turn you into a profane libertine or anything like that.
No, not always. Only sometimes. But I saw it when I was a child, and I've saw it over and over again over the years, and it is ensconced as one of my favorite comedies. Mostly, I mean, then was because I thought it was funny. Because it has a happy ending with these two guys making the Dukes look like idiots. I didn't really think, you know, I was a child, even into my teens and young adult. I didn't think much about anything beyond, I think it's funny. When did Trading Places first happen upon you, Andrew?
Trading Places first happened upon me much, much later in life. Again, sort of a similar story to Coming to America. I want to say at some point in college, I caught part of it on cable, but didn't watch it beginning to end. And I don't think I watched it stem to stern until the last couple of years. So I do not quite have the same cherished memories from childhood to buoy the film in my memory or give me the same sentimental attachment to it that it might for other folks.
Yes, nostalgia. I make no bones the fact that nostalgia does color my appreciation of the film, even though I still think it has its merits beyond my personal grasp, appeal, grip, word, my personal grip word for it.
there's nothing wrong with nostalgia. Nostalgia is a perfectly good reason to enjoy something. It's just not what it used to be.
Right. And your review on your blog is very good, well written as always.
Very kind.
I only speak the truth. I think my largest defense, stage my defense on Trading Places, is that it was made in 1983. It was released in 1983. Probably made in 82, but released in 1983. Before I was born, I was not alive when it first came out. And there are certainly things in this. I don't think it's a perfect movie. It's not a perfect comedy. I don't know what is a perfect comedy, Andrew.
Oh, that's a tough call. I don't know. I don't know if there is one. At least, you know, 2 weeks from now, I'll be driving home and I'll say, damn it, it's this movie. But I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Because I can think of my favorite comedies. I don't know if I'd call any of them perfect.
Does The Princess Bride count as a comedy?
I would not call it a comedy. I looked up lists of 80s comedies just to get like a range of like what was coming out around the same time and what are people consider comedies, which there's a lot of movies on these lists that I'm like, that's not really, it's funny. That doesn't make it a comedy. Like I laugh when I watch Spider-Man. That doesn't make it a comedy. The Princess Bride, I would call it an adventure movie.
I would say maybe Groundhog Day.
Groundhog
I would
Day.
Consider that pretty perfect, but again, it's got at least somewhat of a dramatic bent to it at times.
Groundhog Day is certainly in those contenders for me. Groundhog Day, I love Clue. I'm not sure, and it's very, very good, and like it has a lot of craft in it, much like Groundhog Day does, where the making of it is half as interesting to me as the film itself. I mean, there's other comedies I like that I would not even get close to calling perfect, but I still love them a lot just because of personal appeal. But Groundhog Day, and I don't know, Groundhog Day also, I tend to still resist it. It does have that kind of creepy, like, this dude, like, trying to make, you know, poor Andy McDowell. It's often been said, if you look at the movie from Andy McDowell's character's perspective, it is a horror movie.
Well, okay, we will package this discussion for another time. We'll have our Groundhog's Day. But I think the whole point of it is that he stops being creepy and starts earnestly taking an interest in her, and that's when things change.
Right. And I think that I'm fine. I largely disagree with that criticism. I'm just saying, like, I understand it to a certain point. But I think Trading Places, it has problems in the third act. Like, it is... like you pointed out, you're 100% correct, and I think it's the one thing I didn't even bother arguing with you on Twitter, is the third act is a mess. For the train, everything on the train is a mess. It doesn't need to be that way. It doesn't need to be that, I think.
I was going to say, I don't want to necessarily have too much synergy with the Simpsons show here, but... I would go so far as to call the third act of Trading Places akin to many Mike Scully era third acts on The Simpsons.
You're not
right down to a zoo animal engaging in forced intercourse with somebody.
Does it? I mean, they're wearing suits. That's the discussion you have to end up having. Sometimes you're like, but how could it rape a man? Like it doesn't. It's not like there's a, is it like the suit, does that Halloween costume have like a bathroom spot where like the, don't answer that question. We're going to
comedy
skip right. Yeah, I know. Exactly. I do say I don't like the train parts at all. Really. I mean, it's, I think it has its charm in a certain extent. Some of it has charm, I think, because of the sheer charisma of these people. Eddie Murphy is able to turn chicken shit into chicken salad sometimes just because of his sheer charisma. And I still think that the train sequence is largely garbage and doesn't need to be in the movie. And there's much cleverer ways to get them the MacGuffin, get them the report, this confidential orange juice report.
I was going to say, it doesn't even accomplish that much at the end of the day.
Yeah, they just get the report and that's all it is. And it's like, it is very much like, it felt like we need to make this funny. What do we do? So it felt very kind of like we need to. What? How do we make this a sequence from the Robert Redford Watergate movie?
All
the President's
Men. All the Kingsmen's.
Whatever it is. They need to. We need to do this scene, but make it funny. And they're like, well, let's have a zany train sequence where everyone's in costumes.
Culturally insensitive costumes.
That's, yes, also true. I mean, one culturally insensitive costume, to be fair.
Most of them are culturally insensitive. It's just to a ridiculous degree compared to the other.
I think one's offensive. I was openly offensive. Yes. The other three, I think, are... fairly mundane. Eddie Murphy asking What is the character? Clarence Beeks, played by Paul Gleason. If he wants jerky, I don't find that's not offensive in any way. It's a little silly, but it's not offensive. I do find that funny, like him constantly hoisting, "Would you like some jerky?" in this terrible African accent.
It's, I mean, I don't know if it rises to the level of offensive. It's certainly not great, Bob.
I don't mind it, really. Like, it, I'm not going to try and defend blackface, Dan Aykroyd's blackface. I will only say that I don't think they knew better.
Well, I guess let me set that aside briefly, because okay. I think...
All right.
Well, let me put two things into play. So one is that I think inevitably when you come to a work of art that has been made many decades ago, you kind of have to take it as you find it to some degree. And you have to accept that things are going to meet the standards of the time and rationally understand that in a way that they may not meet the standards of your time. But at the same time, sorry to use that word so much, I also feel very strongly that it's totally fine to have that take you out of the movie. And even if you can accept something rationally, emotionally and psychologically, it can be pretty hard to just intuitively get into a film when there's blackface and, you know, shouted slurs at women and all this other stuff that just makes it hard to warm to a film, even if you can understand why it is the way it is. And I think the other half of that is that comedy in particular ages like really old cheese. You know, it's what the standards of comedy are somewhat universal. Like there's certain things that are going to be funny no matter when you do them that just tickle the human funny bone. But so much of comedy ends up being a reflection of a certain time and a certain mood and a certain spirit in a community at a given time. And it doesn't always translate perfectly. And I think more so than drama, I think you can watch a drama from, you know, 100 years ago. And it obviously there's going to be some translation issues, but at the same time, you can be moved by it in a way that I think it's much harder to find a comedy from 100 years ago as knee-slappingly funny as one that is directly aimed at you and your demographic and your sensibilities will in 2019. And I think those are probably the two prongs of trading places for me. That, you know, one, there are some of those culturally insensitive artifacts that I don't necessarily cast aspersions on anybody for putting in there at the time, even if I think even in 1983, probably knew weren't great, but just hinder my ability to get into the film. And I also think there's just some conventions that are not necessarily offensive, but are just a little passé now about the film that make it harder for me to get into it as well.
I looked up many blackface. Turns out, hey, Andrew, we still have a problem with blackface in 2019.
We do? We haven't solved the racism problem?
We haven't. I know. It's a breaking news. Apparently, we haven't solved racism. So it was very easy to find articles, even that mentioned Trading Places, actually. But they're like, oh, in the long ago days, comedies have always had these things where you don't know what, you know, they make it okay because it's comedy, you know, and then that's the whole point. You know, that's why blackface is bad, is because it is trying to camouflage racism and make it funny. And then you're like, oh, well, it's harmless. It doesn't. No, it definitely is harmful. And so I'm no defense of it. I would just say I will cut them some slack and say it's 1983. There are many other, like, they I read that today too. What's that terrible movie where the whole movie the guy is in blackface because he goes to Soul Man? Oh my
god, good lord,
so bad.
Talk about something that I mean. So there was a tweet about Green Book, right, literally seconds after it won the Best Picture Oscar. That was something like, "Hey, remember when the Oscars selected Green Book as their best picture? Man, that choice hasn't aged well." I feel like the same thing had to be true of Soul Man. Like 5 seconds after that came out, somebody had to understand that this wasn't a good idea. But again, another podcast for another day.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of blackface that is, there's still like, there's still white characters still playing people of color all the time. It's getting better, but still is a problem. So
Billy Crystal at the Oscars themselves, not that long ago.
Yeah. Oh, right. Oh, God. Billy Crystal. Right. Or his one man show where he plays a black blues man, jazz man, black jazz man, a la Bleeding Gums Murphy. Whew, that not good. The train sequence is not good. I think it is the only sequence in the movie that I tune out, that I go, I just kind of half pay attention. I love everything else. And everything else?
Every other part of that movie?
Yeah, I think so. I largely do. I mean, I don't think it's perfect, but I do think it really, aside from the train sequence, it really efficiently uses its time. It packs a lot of character. It packs a lot of character building in a relatively short amount of time. I'm not saying all the characters are incredibly deep or nuanced, but there is a large central cast that all get a reasonable amount of time. We understand who and what they are, what they want. Each of them have little tiny their own moments that we get to focus on them. I absolutely love. I'm reading your review. I'm not necessarily sure if you are. I don't know. I love the happy ending. I love them winning, all the, becoming the rich people and retiring to this tropical island or whatever they're doing. I know it's kind of formulaic, but that's kind of what I want in a comedy. You know, that's what they always say about Shakespeare. The comedies, everyone gets married and is happy. And the dramas, everyone dies. A bunch of funerals. Comedies end in weddings. Dramas end in funerals. Tragedies end in funerals, really. But whatever. I think that, especially considering that this movie came out in 1983, I think it's relatively progressive. Considering it came out in 1983, I think it's relatively progressive and holds up a lot more than a lot of other 80s comedies. Like, I don't know how many 80s comedies you're familiar with, Andrew. Many?
So I would say I've seen a decent number of them. Most of them in the last 10 years, I would say. Like, it was just kind of something that escaped my cultural bubble for a while. But, you know, again, I've seen Groundhog Day, Caddyshack, Stripes, I guess anything with Bill Murray in it. if you'd asked me this a decade ago, it would be very few, but I would say now I've probably at least seen most of the notable ones.
Right. And like you said, I try and keep things in the same time period, you know, try and judge things by how they release in their time period. And you think back to other movies of that time period, other comedies of the time period, especially. Not all of them had blackface, but they certainly treated women worse. They treated sex worse. They weren't as clever with their humor, and they don't hold up, I think, thematically. I think, hey, two dudes trying to get over on some oligarchs is pretty prescient topic for 2019.
I mean, sure, but it's not really presented as I guess let's put it this way. I think that the social commentary goes out the window when they get on that damn train. That from there on out, it just becomes the good guys defeat the bad guys, and they have a convoluted scheme to do it. And there's not anything deeper to it beyond, hey, look, these guys that you tried to mess with are now messing with you. How does it feel? We've got the reversal. And, you know, not every comedy has to set the world on fire in terms of its subtext or depth. It's perfectly fine to have a movie that just gives you that good feeling of the characters you like triumphing over the characters that you don't like. What kills me about Trading Places is that I think that commentary is there. It's baked into the premise. It is the thing that makes it relevant in 2019, to where I may have even said this in the tweet thread that we had, that I'd love to see a remake of this movie with, you know, like Tiffany Haddish and Adam Scott or something like that. Like, I think you could do this premise and the premise is still relevant. But I feel like in the first act, you have a lot of really interesting class comparisons going on just from showing the different lives of Dan Aykroyd's character and Eddie Murphy's character. And I think you even have it in the second. I disagree with you. I don't think the film is very efficient at all. I think it has a great first act that really does take its time to establish character and establish worlds and make sure you know what the premise and the setup of the film is. And then in the second act, you make the flip and it kind of blows through all that character development. But even despite the fact that they both drift incredibly quickly into their new roles, there is that social commentary to the idea that Valentine suddenly becomes this stuffy aristocratic guy and Aykroyd's character is completely lost without this safety net that he kind of always assumed would be there. There is really potent commentary in that, and I like it, and I wish the film had capitalized on it instead of just diving headlong into, hey, we're going into another zany adventure, and what do you know, at the end of the day, we put one over on the bad guys and relax in a desert island, and that's that.
Hey, I mean, tropical island.
Tropical island, pardon me.
Be fair, there's Mai Tais involved.
I'll give the film its due, at least geographically, if nothing else. I think, honestly, that is the problem that I have. That is the thing that keeps me from really liking the movie, beyond just those sort of 80s artifacts that are in some ways not its fault. It's the fact that it feels like there is so much missed potential to it, that it does a lot of things really well. And if it just kept doing them or kept capitalizing on that, it could be, if not a perfect movie, then at least a movie I would consider very good. And it instead just sort of shuffles that aside and gives you a standard 80s comic ending.
I mean, I don't think... I did have the benefit of watching this movie after I read your review. So I had a little... I could watch it and try and parse your criticism through it versus the other way around. I don't think Billy Ray ever actually, like, I don't think he becomes that aristocrat, really. You're right, it does happen very fast. It happens within a space of a couple days. Literally three days, I think, is, I don't know, I, it's, that is the, they're not clear about how much time passes at a certain point, but it's not a lot of time between the switch and they win. You know, the New Year's Day, because it's like, I mean, we have a Christmas party, like, it seems like maybe a week or two over the total length of the movie. I'm not sure. It doesn't make it clear.
And I'm willing to cut the movie slack about literal time. It doesn't have to be that, like, oh man, he becomes a different person in a week. That's implausible. It just has to feel like more. It has to feel like he's been through more to make that change. And I do think, I'm not saying he becomes entirely the Winthorpe character. I'm not sure that he embodies that immediately, but it does change who he is in a pretty marked way very fast. And I think more than the literal amount of time it takes, it just feels like the change itself happens very suddenly and without a lot of provocation or cause.
I mean, I think that there's one scene that I totally forgot about. It's very short too, and I really like it. Now that I have watched the movie again, and now I'm like, oh, right, that it is because Billy Ray is bailed out of jail by the Dukes and he's offered their deal. He's like, hey, we're just going to give you money. We're going to give you a job. We're going to rehabilitate you, or whatever words they use. We're going to give you a salary job, make all the money. You're going to have a butler. You're going to have a house. You're going to have a car. You're going to have everything you need. And they take him to the fancy house, and he's suddenly like, hey, yeah, he has a butler, and he has a jacuzzi, and then he goes out that very night to an old hangout, you know, in a regular bar for, you know, lower to middle class people go to, not a fancy place. And he flashes his money around, and then we get him like, and we get like basically that one scene to show like him enjoying his wealth with his former quote unquote friends.
And it's a good excuse to have an 80s party scene.
It does have,
which all 80s comedies must have by law.
Does it? Is that, I did not, where is that law, by the way? Is it in the book that I need? Can I get that book somewhere?
I believe it's in the Harold Ramis reporter code.
Oh man, if that was actually a thing, I would absolutely adore it. I would love to read that.
It's written in our hearts, Robbie.
Okay. But then we have, and we segue into the 80s party scene, but I think that that scene doesn't do a normal, typical 80s party thing, 80s scene, because our protagonist, is the person who breaks up the party. And that shift does happen quickly, but I don't think that scene necessarily means that he is suddenly, that scene doesn't transition him as far as it may seem, I think. Because, like, yeah, he kicks everyone out. He's like, get out, because everyone's destroying his nice stuff now. He's like, oh, now I own a lot of stuff, and now it's getting destroyed, and now I'm the owner of these things, and now suddenly my opinion has changed about it. Which, I mean, it's not out of the realm of belief for me. If I was suddenly given many things that are very, very nice, and I've never had them before, I could foresee myself going, no, what are you doing? Just because you're my friend doesn't mean you can put out cigarettes on the carpet. What are you doing? Don't do that.
I don't have a problem with that. I think that part of it is fine. It makes total sense to me that he says, suddenly I have things, and so I care about things being hurt. But then I think there's a marked shift in his demeanor and opinions after that. Not only is he just like, okay, they're messing up my stuff, he starts having opinions about, like, no, you have to be tough on these people, you know, otherwise they get too big for their britches, and they're just thieves and freeloaders. And suddenly he's spouting not just, you know, he's not just defending the things that he has and wants to keep nice. His entire worldview has shifted from this. And I think that's what the movie is trying to sell, that this is his epiphany moment there. He's like, oh, well, I suddenly have wealth and I have objects of expense and niceness to protect, and thus I am a different person now. I don't know. I think there's a clear transition for him in that scene, and it happens so fast from my perspective.
I think it is that there isn't, he doesn't have, Billy Ray doesn't have, like, neither, that's another interesting thing about these characters, is neither of them have friends. Really?
Well, Winthorpe does. They're just not actually friends.
That's what I mean. They're not. I mean, they're the same. Like, Billy Ray's, the people he hangs out with at the party or at the bar, or the people he's piling around with in jail, they're not his friends. He knows them, and they are like, he'll, like, you know, hang out with them and talk to them about life, but they're not friends. And Winthorpe's. Those guys are definitely not his friends. They are just, hey, we are also rich people in this club. Hello, we are co-workers, therefore, and because we are, there's only 8 rich people here, we are all friends. Sort of. We'll play racquetball together? Squash? Something? I know they refer to some rich person sport.
They're well-wishers in that they don't wish Winthorpe any direct harm.
Exactly.
Specific harm, pardon me. 1,000 pardons.
How dare you. But they don't really have friends, neither of them. And I feel like that's, I like the parallels between their two characters. And I don't think Billy, like, the scene I was leaning there at my own convoluted path. But it's the scene directly after that night. It is the morning when he is going to work for the first day. And I think it's honestly Denholm. How do you say his name? Do you have any idea? Denholm?
I have.
Dental?
I believe it's pronounced dental. I have no idea.
Okay, dental. My life. Dental Elliot, who plays Goldman. It's something I've never noticed before, but his acting in that little small scene is really, really good. And I wish he had a little bit more to do, but I'm not gonna like blame the movie for not having more things for everyone who's not Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy to do. because it is their
vehicle. I'll blame it for not having more for Jamie Lee Curtis to do.
We're going to get to Jamie Lee Curtis, okay? We're going to get to Ophelia. I want to talk about Ophelia some, for sure. Okay? I've not forgotten about Ophelia.
Join us next time for our Hamlet podcast.
Andrew, if you want to do a Hamlet podcast, I am down. I've seen four different versions of Hamlet in film. I've seen it on stage. I have opinions about Hamlet.
Well, I'd like to do it, but I can never kind of gin up enough courage to actually do it. Oh,
God, I hate you. I hate Hamlet the man. The character, I like the play a lot. I hate the character so much. I hate him. But that's the point. You're supposed to like, why don't you do something? Come on, decide.
If only he had ended up on a tropical island of some kind.
I know, man. I would love Hamlet.
Just hanging out with Laertes, sipping Mai Tais.
There's a scene when Billy Ray is about to go into work for the first time, and Coleman has driven him to the office, and he opens the door, and Billy Ray gets out, and there's a moment where it's like maybe 30 seconds to a minute long, and Billy it just goes to Coleman. He's like, well, Coleman, what's going on? What am I supposed to do? Like, what is this? And it's very clear, like, I don't think Billy Ray has bought in and this. He's very clearly like, I don't know what these two white dudes, these old white rich dudes are doing with me. I don't know why I'm here. He's already seen, I think on the drive over, that's when he sees Winthorpe in the taxi cab, and Winthorpe yells at him. He's like, hey, that's my car. He's wearing wearing his clothes or whatever. And so obviously right then that is a tell, like, what is going on? I saw that dude yesterday. I got arrested because I messed with him accidentally. So I accidentally knocked him over. And now he's in a taxi cab wearing a shoddy suit yelling at me saying I stole stuff from him while I'm now basically in his position with his former bosses. And like, it's a clear, like, something's wrong. Something's weird. And then Billy Ray gets out of the car and he goes to Coleman, and he's like, what do I do, Coleman? Like, what am I supposed to do? And Coleman, the whole time, is like constantly just muttering under his breath about how terrible everyone is.
He's not wrong.
He's like, oh, those, what scumbags. He says as he gets off the phone, Winthorpe tells him, you can have the dessert. Which, why didn't he eat the dessert? It looked good.
No. Maybe he's lactose intolerant. I don't know.
It looked like, you know, crepes with like orange sauce or something. It looked really good. Maybe he didn't want sweets, but, he's throwing it in the garbage.
He's diabetic.
It might be the case. He throws it in the garbage, and you know, like, Coleman says to him, he's like, because he doesn't know what to tell him because he does work for the Dukes. He is obligated to do what they say or he will lose his job. And he's like, just be true to yourself. At least they can't take that from you.
I think that is wallpaper in a sequence and a character transformation where Eddie Murphy spends a lot of time as the rough and tumble Ed Valentine and a lot of time as the corporate stooge Billy Ray Valentine. And I don't think he spends a lot of time in between. I think he probably spends more time issuing homophobic slurs than he does actually transitioning from one position to another.
Have you ever watched Eddie Murphy's stand-up?
Andrew? I have, and it is unlistenable in 2019.
You are correct. I agree with you. It just, I was thinking about it the entire time, like, this is so tame compared to Raw and Delirious? Is that the other one?
Yep, that's right.
Okay. I also watched them as a very young child when I probably shouldn't have.
Yeesh, that more than Trading Places.
I mean, I had no idea what he was talking about. You know, it was so, like, well over my head. I had no idea, like, it was on HBO. I was like, oh, this is that guy in the movie I saw. Oh, I don't know what's going on. Why is he wearing a red leather suit and yelling a lot about women that I don't get it.
It's Donkey from Shrek. I wonder what he's up to now.
That transformation that Eddie Murphy That's the other thing that I just, it's still staggering to me. Eddie Murphy was 22 in this movie. 22 years old.
He was 17 when he went to Saturday Night Live, I want to say.
I know. It's crazy to me that he was so young and such a superstar at such a young age. And
it's a wonderkind.
Yeah. And I mean, like, Dan Aykroyd had only done SNL at this point. Eddie Murphy had only done SNL at this point and then had done 48 Hours. And then 40 Hours was a super amazing hit. And then this, and then Beverly Hills Cop, which made him the super duper star. And Jamie Lee Curtis had only done the Halloween movies. It's the only things of any note she had done so far, which are like interesting. I love Halloween. The first one, especially.
I say the original is amazing.
The original is very good. And the genre defining created a genre, basically created slasher films. Unless you want to count Psycho, which I kind of. Psycho's its own thing, I think. But, I mean, it does have a slasher in it, sort of. But it's still a horror movie. It is not mainstream. They're still huge. What's the word I'm looking for, Andrew?
Gaps?
Not that. I can't...
Stigma?
Stigma. There you go. Stigma about serious actors in horror movies. And they don't get respect for, especially I think Get Out was finally like, even though people still don't want to call it a horror movie, someone called it a social thriller. What is
they're trying to overcome the stigma.
It's a horror movie. It's okay. Okay. That's just my own personal, I have feelings.
I mean, for what it's worth, my wife has a theory that you call it a romantic comedy unless it's good. And then you just call it a drama.
I think that's fairly accurate. Never mind. I've gone on so many tangents. I can't afford 100 of them. Future Robbie can't afford them when he has to edit them out. but I think everyone is very, very young in this. And that also is very much like, I didn't know that then, but it makes me appreciate the movie more now that everyone in this movie wasn't the people we know them as now. You know, Dan Aykroyd hadn't done Ghostbusters yet. Eddie Murphy hadn't done Beverly Hills Cop yet. You know, Jamie Lee Curtis, she hadn't done A Fish Called Wanda yet, which was 5 years later.
Say what you will about this movie, and I don't think anybody could dispute that it is incredibly well cast. And I think that's what, to your point, saves it a lot of times when I find some of the writing and some of the 80s artifacts to be really trying. Sometimes through sheer force of will, Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd and Jamie Lee Curtis can sell something. And that buoys a lot of the weaker moments of the film. But that also just makes it that much more frustrating to me when it drops the ball. Because it's sort of like, you've got Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy and Jamie Lee Curtis. Like, use them. Use them well. They're right there.
I mean, I don't think they were thinking, like, one, this movie's already 2 hours long. I mean, even if you cut the train sequence and replace it with something shorter, that's not that much time. It's like, what, 15, 10 minutes of the movie?
Something like, I think it's longer, but it could be mixed up.
I mean, I don't. It seems longer than it is, I think, because it's not great. It seems like, it's 9 o'clock at night. I've been watching this train sequence for 7 hours. But
temporal relativity kicks in when you're on a train.
Yeah, exactly. But even if you cut that stuff out, it's going to have, if it has even more stuff in there in the middle, it's going to be an extraordinarily long movie. And that's asking a lot, I think, from a studio comedy, even in 1983, to make it like two-hour and 15-minute movie or something like that.
I don't think there's a lot that needs to be added. I do think there's things that can be streamlined and things that could be paced better. It's really more having fewer scenes where Eddie Murphy walks upstairs to find topless women than more scenes where he's slowly but surely being indoctrinated rather than presto changeo becoming the, you know, evil corporate stooge guy.
I mean, I don't think he ever becomes that, though. At least not.
I think he almost does at the end before he overhears the Duke brothers using a racial slur, which again is part and parcel with, I mean, at least there it's used for a purpose to try to establish that these are the bad guys, but I feel like there's a lot of not great racial stuff in the film.
I mean, I don't, I think as far as I could tell, that is not used as a laugh line. I don't think it's intended as one.
I agree with that.
I think it is intended as Eddie Murphy. We are, even as if I'm trying to paint myself as Joe Everyman, who's not me, we have grown to empathize with Billy Ray and like him as a character. And then we see him understand, oh, these men really are. These men don't care about me. They think I am garbage. They think I'm not human, you know?
I 100% agree with that assessment. I have some qualms about this being the method to get there, but
I mean,
it's certainly an efficient one to establish these guys as bad guys. Right. I will not dispute that.
I
question whether there could be other ways to do it where you don't have to have them dropping end bombs.
I mean, one, it's a thing I thought about in this movie after I watched it was this kind of, they don't make this anymore. Like, they don't make comedies like this much anymore. Comedies have changed. I mean, like you said earlier when you're talking about, like, yeah, we can't watch when you watch a comedy from 50 years ago, what is it anymore? 100 years ago, like, the temporally, comedies have changed structure a lot of ways, and it's, you know, oftentimes it is adjusting what is acceptable now in our current pop culture, and trying to make things that accommodate, you know, what a vision, whatever that means, even though I don't know how many, very few comedies are, and I don't know if that, like, I think some of it that's good in some ways, and I think it's bad in others. Like, it is generally, you know, I see this sentiment a lot in different circles online, in some people, obviously, in some ways, it is very good because there are more movies that are more welcoming to more people, and I have no problem with that. But it also feels like a lot of films in particular, I think it's probably shifted to television largely, but
I was going to say, I think that's probably my response. I think they do make comedies like these. It's just on the small screen rather than the big one.
But it's kind of dirty. And I don't mean dirty like, oh, it's like crass jokes or like, you know, toilet humor or, you know, curse words or nudity or whatever. I mean, like, it feels kind of like movies about poor people. There aren't any.
I don't know if that's true. I mean, it's hard. I guess it's harder to think of comedies. There's certainly dramas.
Comedies about poor people.
Yeah, I would say that the inheritors of this sort of thing are probably the likes of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and shows that kind of follow in its footsteps. I do think this sort of humor exists. It's just sort of translated elsewhere.
It's Always Sunny. Touche. That is the dirtiest. The dirtiest of television shows, and I do mean dirtiest and just filthy, gross, in all the nicest ways. I agree that, yeah, Always Sunny does. Although, sometimes I think it overdoes it a little bit. But I think I have no problem with a single use of the N-word from villains that are the Dukes. They're bad guys, they're rich, old, white dudes who hold power, and they even say it at the very end of near the end of the movie, and at the final scene, or second to final scene, I suppose, when they're like, we founded this exchange, we've always said it, it's ours, we own it. And, you know, they are the most powerful men. And I don't have an issue with I don't think it gets overused. Using it one time to make it very clear what these type of men are, because I think, like, I think the Dukes are actually written pretty cleverly. I mean, I don't think they're deep characters, but I think that the fact that one is kind of a gentler guy, and the other one is clearly, Don Amici's is clearly, I forget which Duke is which. Mortimer is generally, now I'm doubting myself. Yes, Mortimer is harsh and mean and expects the worst from Billy Ray, and more overtly racist.
I mean, in isolation, it may not be the worst thing in the world. I think it's a little cheap, and I also think that taken with the other elements of the film, which have some questionable racial politics and, you know, presentation in play, it makes me more sensitive to it than I might otherwise be. It feels like there's certain blind spots in the perspective of the film, and I don't know if that individual scene is a indicator of that, but it makes it hit my radar more than it might otherwise, given the other problems I have with the film on that front.
Okay, well, I'll finish my thought and then we get to those other problems. I'm glad it makes it clear that these, what kind of racist these men are. Because even in 2019, by God, there are still people who, they don't use any ethnic slurs. They don't, about whoever, whatever the person were, are they racist? Question. Or are they behaving as a racist? Which is the same. They don't use ethnic slurs. They just feel this particular way about this blah, 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 blah. And it's very easy to see, Randolph is painted as the soft, more kind Duke, while Mortimer is the harsher, more overtly racist Duke. That scene makes it very clear that, no, they're the same. They're the same man. Regardless of how they couch, maybe, how they talk about people of color, they are both the same awful racist. What are the other issues you're talking about that color your thoughts about it?
Again, the blackface, some of the depiction of Eddie Murphy's character prior to his transformation, some of the characterizations of Eddie Murphy's character after his transformation. There's a certain extent to which there is an almost patronizing tone to the film. At the same time, it wants to be very humane to the Billy Ray Valentine character. And, you know, maybe some of that is that it wouldn't shock me if a lot of it is just letting Eddie Murphy be Eddie Murphy. And if you listen to his stand-up, not all of it is great and not all of it is super flattering. And some of that's just going to come through in 2019 in a way it's not going to in 1983. But it's hard to disaggregate that from some of the film's larger blind spots about those things. In addition to that scene, I think there's a lot of ways in which Eddie Murphy is presented prior to the character's transformation. I think there's a lot of ways after his transformation. I think obviously the blackface and sort of the cultural stereotypes that are used, it all kind of becomes a big bundle to me. And some of that may just be instances where if you have a comedy, you're going to let Eddie be Eddie. And if you listen to his stand-up, a lot of the stuff he does here is not a far cry from that. So it's hard to know how much of this is just on letting the performer do their shtick and how much of it is the film and the writers and the director stepping in and saying, this is the kind of movie we want to make. But I do think there's times in which the film is attempting to portray African-American characters a certain way, and it can come off patronizing or condescending or even to the level of offensive in places that make me question the larger project at times, even though it's clearly trying to be humane and trying to be on the Billy Ray Valentine character's side ultimately. I think sometimes it does so in ways that show the blind spots of it, certainly the makers of the film and perhaps just comedy audiences in 1983 that stand out in a way in 2019 they didn't then.
I mean, I don't know. It's hard, like you said, it's hard to parse some of that stuff because of the time it's been since it happened. That movie came out, you know, 30 plus years ago, plus about the impact of Eddie Murphy and how much, you know, his performance, how much of it is him versus what a bunch of, you know, this movie's directed by John Landis. It is, you know, a white man and written by white men. So, yeah, I don't know. I always fall back on, and even I did it, when I watched this, is this movie is on the side of the lower class. It is the villains. Every rich person is a villain. Until the end when, hey, we've got ours. I mean, I'm not going to defend, like, hey, it's still, at the end, it's a very capitalist movie. Because it's very much like, no, well, we got our money, so we're good now. Goodbye. Goodbye, poor life.
Bye. Exactly. I mean, I think it's clear that they mean well. I don't know that they always do well.
Speaking of that, let's talk about Ophelia. Let's talk about Jamie Lee Curtis. I love the silence. It's great.
Again, I feel like this has got to be a, like, ha, no, you know how it feels moment. Like, I don't know. Here you have, So I guess let me put it this way. I think the Ophelia character is another instance where I am just so frustrated by the missed opportunity. Because you introduce her, you have Jamie Lee Curtis, who, whether they knew it or not at the time, is a very talented actress, and you have this sort of third option to the dichotomy that the film is trying to draw between Winthorpe and Valentine. You have this concept that, hey, here is the stuffy heir apparent, and here is the raised on the street hustler character, and if you flip their positions, their opinions and their bearing would change too. And at the same time, you have halfway through the movie this other possibility, which says, yeah, here's somebody who is who they are, is who she is, regardless of her circumstances. She understands what her position is. She understands what her talents are, and she has a plan for how she's going to use them to live a life that is going to be comfortable and satisfying for her. In a movie where you have the two main characters fluctuating and being unmoored by their change in circumstances, here is somebody who feels like she has her compass and knows what direction she's going, regardless of where you place her on the map. And it's so frustrating that after you have that scene that establishes this and establishes who she is and how she is an alternative to these two ideas that the Dukes are so committed to, from then on in the movie, she is either taking her clothes off or nannying the Dan Aykroyd character. That is all she exists to do in the film from that point on. They have one really interesting setup, and the rest of the movie is just boobs and whatever I have to do to make Winthorpe happy. And it drives me up a frickin' wall. And I'll say that name one female character in this film whose purpose is not chiefly to take off her clothes and or serve the two main characters' interests.
I mean, I largely agree with you, Andrew, about that she has a lot of potential. They could do more. It's one, I think it's a different movie. It's not this movie. This movie is fairly...
You're right, it's a better movie.
In 1983, I'm not sure about that. In 2019, maybe. 2019, like you said, they should... I agree, I had the very same thought today. Like, they should remake this movie. They should change the structure around. They should make, you know, in more, they could say a lot more with it, but I don't, this movie doesn't want to be that. It wants to largely be a studio comedy, and I can't, it's a vehicle for Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. Everything else is in service to that, including Jamie Lee Curtis.
I mean, I don't want to fall into the trap of judging a movie based on what you want it to be rather than what it is. And maybe I'm guilty of that here. It's just really hard for me to watch the film and not see the way it comes this close or points itself in a certain direction that I find really interesting and then just sort of veers into something that I don't find interesting and in some ways find either dull or outright bad.
You're review says as much, and you probably don't know of Austin Walker. Do you know who that is, the name?
I do not. That's a new one on me.
Okay. He's largely a video game critic. He is the editor-in-chief at Waypoint, which is Vice's video game vertical. I believe I'm using all the right terms for that. He's a video game critic. He's our age, maybe even younger a little bit, but he is an incredibly intelligent and really astute critic of video games and of art in general. He's a person of color, to make it clear. And he said, I don't know when he said this, but he kind of uses it as a refrain a lot of the time when people get upset about his criticism, because he's fairly critical about a lot of stuff, and he is not afraid to call out any sort of prejudice or influence on art and its kind of grander thematic implications, regardless of if it's a video game or if it's a movie or if it's a television show or if it's music. He will say this part of this thing is bad, and we should make it clear. I'm going to make it clear. This is bad. This part of this thing, whatever it is. And then people will say, but why are you so negative? Blah, 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 blah. He's like, well, I just want to make my thoughts clear about this. I'm not going to say that this whole thing is bad. There, he'll segment off those things and then segment off this one good thing about this movie. I take this one thing and I say, that's really good and really interesting and really clever and worth the art. And he says it because there's a lot of stuff I don't enjoy, largely because it doesn't appeal to me and because it has beliefs that are kind of, he's sometimes vehemently against, but he's an incredibly intelligent critic. He encounters a lot of stuff that he can only enjoy small parts of it. He can only take out small things that he can appreciate. And I try and keep that viewpoint, I think, is incredibly valuable. Where when you, like, hey, I'm in Simpsons season 12, I'm trying really hard just to take out the small things that I enjoy and say, this is valuable. This is good. I enjoy this a lot. And trying to cherish that. And you're right. The Ophelia character is really interesting, and they do a lot to establish her as a very, trope-defying character at first glance. You know, her first meeting with, her first kind of extended intro sequence with her and Winthorpe, and they do a lot to differentiate her from other characters of that type. And then they don't do a bunch with her. She becomes a love interest. She becomes, you know, she becomes the female counterpart to Coleman. They are both servants, basically. And
for a guy that she met like an hour ago and then becomes just preternaturally devoted to.
Yeah, again, I'm not going to disagree with you there. I think that, and that is largely serving the film in that we need to get. We don't have enough time. We need to get to this. We need to get to that train sequence. It's very important. But I try and think about it. How many movies in 1983, how many comedies in 1983 have portray a sex worker like this, as someone who's smart and capable and not just the common, you know, losing my perspicacity, the kind of binary choice between whore or Madonna kind of thing.
Madonna whore complex.
Yeah, that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't do that largely. I think, you know, it settles back into a very simple love interest role near the, like, after the halfway, two-thirds mark. Even though she does get some, you know, comedy scenes in the train sequence, which we don't like the train sequence, but she does have moments of like, hey, I'm also doing comedy, which Jamie Lee Curtis is very good at. But she is presented as a sex worker who is capable, smart, knows what she's doing. She's not a victim. She doesn't have a pimp. She says it specifically. She makes it, and she, I know, and the movie does sort of, it, I think the movie does hurt itself. It's self-inflicted wounds when, you know, she's like, and, you know, everything costs, she's like, she, they have this scene where she's like, rent costs money, food costs money. And then she makes it, and then, you know, she takes her top off and says, and it's not the only thing that costs money in this house, you sleep on the couch. And that kind of, that scene, and you're right about, like, you know, most women in this movie are literally there to just be nude for men. That scene, I will defend the nudity in that, largely because it is, I'm not going to say that I find it blameless, but it is a sort of power play on her part, where, you know, she's a sex worker, she's probably more comfortable with nudity than most people, and she wants to make sure that Winthorpe understands, like, hey, this isn't Pretty Woman.
Again, in isolation, I think it's fine. In the context of the rest of the movie, where women take off their clothes at the drop of a hat for no reason, I have more qualms about it.
I mean,
and I think it's a great scene up to that point. But I mean, even setting it aside, it's far from the movie's worst sins. I just think it's reflective of the perspective on female characters that is being brought to the movie outside of this one scene that gives you the glimmer of hope that they're about to do something different.
I will say this, Andrew, you're not wrong again, but think, can you name other 80s comedies with more than one female character that isn't 9 to 5?
I mean, 80s comedies is something I think I'm at least mildly versed in, but not definitely not my specialty.
I mean, I understand, like, I'm just doing this off the dome. Yeah, here, name some things. But I looked, and there's not a lot. 9 to 5 is one, which 9 to 5 is, like, the most prescient 80s comedy of all time. You're like, wow, that should have been made today. They probably will. They probably will remake 9 to 5. There's probably some screenwriters.
In fact, I want to say I've heard something about it being remade. Okay. I don't know if that's true, but I've at least seen rumblings.
If there isn't officially, there has to be screenwriters somewhere going like, I'm going to remake 9 to 5. This is going to be great. This is perfect. Dolly Parton will be a small cameo. She'll be blah, blah. Like, I imagine that, like, aside from 9 to 5, there's not a lot of one comedies in general, and then specifically like screwball, low, like crass comedies that have any female characters of meaning. Like, what are your thoughts on go ahead.
Okay, so I'm looking at my little letterbox list here.
Okay.
And I again would pick out a few. I don't necessarily think they're great movies, all of them, but they're at least ones that did it. Scrooged has multiple female characters. Heathers has multiple female characters.
Heathers is good.
I don't know if you want to classify it as a comedy, but it certainly veers that way. Beetlejuice has more than one female character.
I don't consider Beetlejuice a comedy. Probably mainly because I find it terrifying. it's way more scary to me.
There's comedies out there.
There are. I just generally I understand the people who call things horror comedies. I generally go, well, that's a horror to me, or that's a comedy to me. Like, I won't begrudge people who call it a horror comedy, but certain movies, I think they are funny to me, and certain movies I go, that's more scary. They're like Ghostbusters, you know, that's a horror comedy to some people. That's just a comedy to me. I don't call that a horror comedy, even though there are definitely scary things in it. Shaun of the Dead, that's a comedy to me. It's not horror to me. Slither, that's a horror movie. There's certainly funny things in it. I would consider that more of a comedy than anything. Have you ever seen Slither?
I have not. It's on my list.
It's very good. James Gunn. What was I talking about? I would say that it's
80s comedies with women in it.
80s comedies with women, and especially an 80s comedy with women that shows a sex worker that isn't just a whore. Isn't just like, hey, they're a hooker. I know the hooker with a heart of gold is a thing. But I feel like that's still, I'm taking that small, I'm going to take that one scene or two scenes, if you want to be generous, and take that out and say, that's good. And it's out of place otherwise in this movie. It doesn't make sense that it exists at all. And I'm not going to, I try not fault the movie for not doing more of a thing that it probably would never do. In 1983.
Okay, but without doing that thing, then she's literally just a prop. Like, that's the only thing that justifies her presence at all in this damn thing.
Well, most of them are props, Andrew. I'm sorry. Most comedies are full of props. They're not...
I would argue that the Dukes and the Butler and even Beaks gets more characterization than she does if you take out that one scene.
Beaks is definitely just a prop. It's just Paul Gleason playing a jerk, which he does in every movie.
typecasting aside.
Yeah, it's I think even like you said, I don't even think Winthorpe and Billy Ray are deep characters. It is like they're following the fairly Prince and the Pauper kind of standard story structure. I think that doing it with a black man as one of your main characters, having a sex worker that has some positive anything, frankly, having that those elements in 1983 is more than I expect. Like name and like. I am largely it is because Eddie Murphy was so incredible at such a young age that he forced himself, hey, I am so good, I make so much money for you, you have to cast me in movies. You have to put me in these movies. I'm going to make you because I'm so good. But I look at all these other movies that are like this at the time, which I actually, you know, and it made me think about, like, how I don't like those. Like, I don't like Stripes. I don't like Animal House. I like Blues Brothers. But I don't like Caddyshack. I don't like any of the I don't know what to call them.
Say the traditional 80s comedies. I think that's...
Yeah, I don't like any of them, but I like this. And I don't... Like, I saw them all, too, when I was a kid. I don't think it has anything to do with nostalgia. I mean, I definitely see the problems with them more and more as I get older, even with this movie. But this... Frankly, I think this movie is just hilarious. We haven't really talked about jokes, because that's kind of like... Talking about jokes is, like, the weirdest... sometimes a hard thing to do, but
killing the frog,
yeah,
it's important.
That scene when Dan Aykroyd is at the Christmas party, leaving the Christmas party with he's stolen all that food, and Billy Ray has just found out that there's about the bet and about the whole situation, and he's yelling after Winthorpe, and Dan Aykroyd just turns. He's drunk, dressed as Santa Claus. I laugh every time. I laugh so hard. And when he's eating the ham and his beard at the same time in the subway. Oh, I love it.
I mean, look. Point a camera at Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy and Jamie Lee Curtis for long enough, you're going to get good comic material.
Andrew,
force of luck.
Andrew.
If nothing else.
Andrew, have you seen Nothing But Trouble?
I have not seen Nothing
But Trouble. Oh my god. That's me. That's Dan Aykroyd without supervision. And
as Vince Russo taught us, we all need some supervision.
Vince Russo. I was not expecting us to bring up that name to come up in our discussion about Trading Places. But
I am just full of obscure references, Robbie.
I mean, it's not obscure to me. That's right in my wheelhouse. But for most people, probably Vince Russo. We're not going to talk about Vince Russo. Ugh, okay. But Dan Aykroyd needs supervision. He needs someone. He needs a Harold Ramis. He needs a Bill Murray to corral his insanity. And I like, that's a John Landis. He needs someone to... No, Dan, we're not gonna... Nothing But Trouble is... It's not the worst movie I've ever seen. It is the movie I've seen that I hate the most.
Wow. It's bold.
I
almost have to see it now.
Here, Andrew, I hate this movie so much, I'm going to tell you, don't ever watch it in your entire life. It's not the worst movie I've ever seen. It's just, I hate it. I hate it so much. flames on the side of my face.
See, now there's a good 80s comedy Clue, that has multiple female characters
Clue,
in it.
Yeah, Clue's amazing, but Clue is also a colossal failure when it first came out. So I don't know how well you can judge it, but it is. I love Clue. Clue's amazing. I will talk at length about Clue. That is largely, I think I try and say, I like this movie because I think it's hilarious. I think the two old rich white dudes lose in the end, which, hey, I'm all for that. It's a feel good moment. It makes me feel amazing every time I watch it. No matter how old I've been, I was a child. I watched it, and I knew those two old guys were mean and bad, and they lost, everything, and it felt great. And when I was a kid, and now I'm,
and they got outsmarted by the people they looked down on.
Exactly, and it's simple, and yes, it's the a astonishingly common way to end a comedy. Or any kind of film that's structured like this. Does not change the fact I still love it. And I still, every time I know what's going to happen, I still just relish in it. I relish in every moment of the stock exchange scene at the end. I love it. Even though for the most part of my life, I had no idea what actually was happening.
It conveys what you need to know. You don't have to understand a lot about commodities markets or orange juice futures or anything like that to get
Yeah.
They've pulled their con. They've pulled off the trick. That's right. All you gotta understand.
Yeah, exactly. And then, exactly. It communicates that. And at a certain point, I was an adult and I'm like, what is that actually happening in that scene of this movie that I like a lot? Why? I should probably figure that out. And I go, oh, that makes sense. Okay. And frankly... Go ahead.
I want to say I read that they changed it or at least had to fight for the ending because a lot of the people at the studio didn't understand it and didn't think that the audience would understand what was happening.
I believe that 100% if that is true because until I was in my 20s, I really had no idea. Well, I mean, I've seen this movie probably a 24 times in my life. And for most of them, I probably didn't actually... I understood the basics. They made money. They made the Dukes lose money. It's not complicated, that part. But I understand, I imagine a lot of the audience didn't know. All they know is that, hey, Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy celebrate at the end, and they dance up and down, and they're happy because they made a lot of money, and the Dukes owe $380 million or something.
The good guys are teaming up despite the fact that they don't really know each other and have just kind of barely sniffed this scheme out.
And I think if you make the train sequence something simpler, I don't think it's that so far-fetched of a scheme. I don't think if it didn't involve gorillas and insane offensive costumes and future former senators... I think it would work better, and I think it would make the plan seem a little bit more cogent. But there are gorillas in the movie. I'm gonna make it very clear. I do not condone any part of the gorillas sections of this movie. Firmly.
Well, that's reassuring, at least.
Firmly against.
Jane Goodall thanks you.
Although, I'm not against gorillas in general.
I don't think one could be. I think gorillas can be delightful and even touch our hearts with their sign language. But I don't think they necessarily have a place when they're used as a comic device for
What is it with
unfortunate comeuppance?
What is it with people thinking animals raping people are so funny? What is happening? Why is that a thing?
Isn't that the old joke? Comedy is when you spill soup on your slacks. Tragedy is when I spill soup on mine. It's funny because it's happening to somebody else, right?
I don't agree with that.
That's the premise. That's what they want you to think. Well, he's a bad guy, and he's dressed up as a gorilla, and now you have the ironic comeuppance that he is being sexually assaulted by a gorilla. Isn't that hilarious? Time to do another line of cocaine.
Reward
myself for such a brilliant gag.
There you go. That might be closer. That might be getting closer to the truth. And it's really interesting to me that John Landis, you're talking about how comedies have aged. John Landis has not made a good movie since the 80s, really. I've looked at all. He's made some amazing movies in the 80s and then made a bunch of stinkers afterwards. He made Blues Brothers. American Werewolf in London, Trading Places, Three Amigos, Coming to America, and then Not Good Things.
I mean, sometimes you're attuned to the zeitgeist for a while, and then you're just not attuned to it anymore. And then you just, what you're selling becomes not what people want. But the other side of the coin is, I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody who enjoys this film, especially you, Robbie.
That's nice of you.
For one thing, comedy is so individual, which I think is part of why it makes it hard to go revisit comedies from several decades ago in a lot of ways. But, at the same time, I do think there's an argument to be made that Trading Places is aiming for something that seems quaint in 2019, but was laudable and not as done in 1983. And I do give it some credit for that. But I also think in some ways it exposes... I don't want to say half-assed job, but maybe it does some of these things in a way that's unsatisfying to us now because they don't go further or don't sort of take them to what I would consider the logical ends. But the other side of the coin is, there's lots of funny things in this movie. There's lots of well done things in this movie. There is a lot of good social commentary in this movie, however handicapped it may be by the times in which it was made. And it's not my cup of tea, but it doesn't bother me that it's anybody else's. And, you know, watch it in good health.
I haven't watched it in a very long time, and it was nice watching it again. It is one of those movies for me where it's like a warm cup of tea. It's just it's comforting. It's comfort food. It's comforting to me just watching it. All right? And I don't really have a rhyme or reason for why certain movies do that and some movies don't. Like movies I like that I can't just watch and just enjoy regardless of the bad parts. I don't care about them. I don't care about the bad parts enough that I go, man, I like how this movie makes me feel. And it just, that's what this is to me. It is a movie where I acknowledge all those problems. I don't know why it's this one. Is it, maybe it's because I have nostalgia for it, but I don't think that's all of it. I don't know. Andrew, what are things that you do on the internet? Where can people find your writing and other things you create?
So people can find the things that I create on my website, which has links to all of my writing from all across the web. That website is theandrewblog.net. It's three words, theandrewblog.net. You can also find me as part of Consequence of Sound's expanded film and TV section, where I did a review of a new television show on Showtime called Black Monday, starring Don Cheadle, which I would in many ways consider kind of a modern day successor to Trading Places, and would encourage you all to check out. And you can also find me on Twitter at TheAndrewBlog. So, Robbie, thank you for letting me come onto your show to trash something that you love. That's very gracious of you.
Hey, like you said, it doesn't happen a lot. It's usually the other way around, where I'm trying to convince people to like something. Unless it's The Simpsons and Matt, and then I'm convincing Matt to hate something, and usually it works. Andrew, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Robbie. Anytime.
Anytime. Thanks again to Andrew for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman. My website is robbiedorman.com. The show's website is serialfanaticist.com, and you can follow our Facebook page at facebook.com/serialfanaticist. If you like the show, give it a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to it. It helps out the show, helps people find it. Give it a good review. Tell your friends. Subscribe. You know the drill. Thanks. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.